The reading today is from Jude, starting at verse 1. Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ and a brother of James, to those who have been called and who are loved in God the Father and kept for Jesus Christ, mercy, peace, and love be yours in abundance. Dear friends, although I was very eager to write to you about the salvation we share, I felt compelled to write and urge you to contend for the faith that was once for all entrusted to God's holy people. For certain individuals whose condemnation was written about long ago have secretly slipped in among you. They are ungodly people who pervert the grace of our God into a license for immorality and deny Jesus Christ, our only sovereign and Lord. Though you already know all this, I want to remind you that the Lord at one time delivered his people out of Egypt, but later destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels who did not keep their positions of authority, but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the great day. In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire. In the very same way, on the strength of their dreams, these ungodly people pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and heap abuse on celestial beings. But even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not himself dare to condemn him for slander, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." Yet these people slander whatever they do not understand, and the very things they do understand by instinct, as irrational animals do, will destroy them. Woe to them! They have taken the way of Cain. They have rushed for profit into Balaam's error. They have been destroyed in Korah's rebellion. These people are blemishes at your love feasts, eating with you without the slightest qualm, shepherds who feed only themselves. They are clouds without rain, blown along by the wind, autumn trees without fruit and uprooted, twice dead. They are wild waves of the sea, foaming up their shame, wandering stars for whom blackest darkness has been reserved forever. Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about them. See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones to judge everyone and to convict all of them of all the ungodly acts they have committed in their ungodliness, and of all the defiant words ungodly sinners have spoken against him. These people are grumblers and fault finders. They follow their own evil desires. They boast about themselves and flatter others for their own advantage.
Great. Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Tom Simpson. I'm another one of the vicars here, and it's great to be with you this morning. As I was preparing for this, I was reminded of the Thomas Hardy book, Jude the Obscure, and it does feel like there are bits of this that are pretty obscure. So hopefully we can bring some clarity to that. So do have your Bibles open. We'll be going through seeking to see if we can bring some clarity and light into what is sometimes a bit of a dark bit of the Bible. So let's have a think. Now, one of the great abiding sentiments of our age is live and let live. We may say that consciously, we may say it unconsciously, But it's there, isn't it? The expectation in society is that we will get on with our lives as we let others get on with theirs. Often we think about this in terms of our likes and dislikes. So I won't make a fuss about your obsession with Cambridge United if you won't make a fuss about my enjoyment of choral music from 400 years ago, or whatever it is. We live and we let live. And in recent years, this idea of living and letting live, well, it's broadened out, hasn't it, to all of our life choices. The world around us constantly advocates for an appreciation of all that is different among us. And the consequence of that is that one of the worst social faux pas that we can make is to say that somebody is not doing the right thing. You might hear a friend or a colleague say, well, who are they to tell me that I shouldn't do whatever it is? How dare they? We see in the media, don't we, the shock and outrage when someone has spoken out about this thing or that thing. Piers Morgan seems to always be getting into trouble for this. And actually, the church has kind of echoed that same sentiment. Christians believe that God has made each one of us different and unique, and so therefore we should live and let live, right? We don't need to be dogmatic. We don't need to fight over different areas of doctrine. We're all different and we can just rub along together. There's an organization in the Church of England called Mosaic, the movement of supporting Anglicans for an inclusive church. In their founding documents, they declare themselves to be a movement which campaigns and models theological breadth, comprehensiveness, and inclusion. And I guess if we ask them, they'd probably say they want to live and let live. And so any church leader or church that declares this thing or that thing to be unacceptable for Christians, to be unorthodox, to use the kind of formal term, well, they're excluded. They're called bigoted or petty. They're refusing to live and let live. Now, why would someone do this? Why would someone argue about faith? Why would they stand against the prevailing culture? Why would they fight for a particular viewpoint? Can't we just agree to disagree? Hugh's already alluded to this, but one of the key verses in Jude, something that sets the whole direction of the letter, is this idea of contending for the faith. It's quite a short letter. We're going to look at the first two-thirds of it today. I'm going to look at it in three sections. We're going to see Jude's key message in the first four verses. We're going to see the first danger in verses 5 to 10, and then a second danger in verses 11 to 16. So let's not beat about the bush anymore. Let's go and see. Verses 1 to 4, kept for Jesus, so keep contending. Now, when we write letters, there's a certain way we're taught to do things, isn't there? We see something like this. So you see your address in the top right-hand corner, and then maybe the date, and then who you're writing to, and then you start the letter, don't you? That's the kind of the convention that we all follow. And in the ancient worlds, they had a similar convention. It's different to what we have today, but it's still a convention. You see that whether you're looking at things in the New Testament or letters that they've dug up in Hadrian's Wall or somewhere like that. They put who they are first, and then who the letter's going to. And often we then get a little clue about what the letter's going to be about. So as we start Jude's letter, it is a letter, we get Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ and a brother of James, to those who have been called, who are loved in God the Father and kept for Jesus Christ. Mercy, peace, and love be yours in abundance. Jude describes himself as a servant of Jesus Christ. He's calling himself a Christian, a brother of James, probably the same James who is a major leader in the early church, probably the leader of the church in Jerusalem. And he's writing to Christians, to those who have been called. It's the same language that the Apostle Peter uses in 1 Peter chapter 2. He describes them as being called out of darkness into God's wonderful light. God's call means that they are loved in God the Father. A Christian is someone who can be confident in their love for them. He sent his son, Jesus Christ, to die for them on the cross, taking the punishment they deserve and being forgiven so that they can be sure of God's love for them. And God's call means that they are kept for Jesus Christ. And this word keeping, kept, is going to run throughout the letter. We'll see it both this week and next week. Nothing can separate us from God. Our place in heaven is secure. We can be confident. So whatever else this letter contains, whatever else God calls us to do, those who've been called by God are kept for Jesus. Jude's writing to reassure Christians of their status, but he also has a particular concern for them too, which comes up in the next few verses. Jude wanted to write about their salvation, presumably a message of hope, message of encouragement. But there's also a warning that he needs to give. And this warning's going to dominate the rest of the letter. They may well be kept for Jesus, but they have to contend for the faith that has been given them. They need to fight. Now, the thing about fighting is that it's an action that requires two parties, isn't it? You can't fight on your own. You can train for the physical side of a boxing match. Oh, I don't know, I haven't boxed, but I understand it's lots of cardio or creating muscle memory for what to do and when. But it's training with a goal in mind, isn't it? To get into the ring, to fight against someone else. In the same way, Jude is urging people to contend for the faith, to fight for it. And they need to fight because of what's in verse 4. There's a problem in the church. There are certain individuals, as you see appear on the screen, whose condemnation was written about long ago. These people have been infiltrating the church, sneaking in, and they are troublemakers. They are serious causes for concern because of their beliefs. There is right belief, which Jude is happy with, that they are kept in the faith. But there are also these people who are advocating wrong belief. They are perverting the grace of our God to make it to make whatever they want acceptable. They're perverting the grace of God, turning it away from its right path into a license for immorality, doing things that God hates. They deny Jesus. They attack the fundamental basis of our faith. This is not a general idea that Jude is encouraging people to fight with, to contend with. These are specific people who are part of the church. These are other people within a Sunday morning service who are trying to bend God's message to suit their own will. And Jude is going to spend the rest of our passage for today addressing the future for these people. And then next week we'll see what people can do to counteract that message. Now, these letters in the New Testament, well, they're written to early Christians, the first churches, to help them deal with the trouble that they were facing. And part of the reason why we still study them today is because although our context has changed, people haven't. The base nature of humanity is still the same. There are still people today in churches who try to pervert the grace of God and deny Jesus Christ. And so we need to be warned as well. We need to hear this call to contend. Now, periodically, we all see adverts warning us of various health dangers. It might be eating too much sugar or fat, or not eating enough fruit or vegetables, or not brushing our teeth, or whatever. But the adverts have to do more than just tell us what they think the problem is. They want to warn us of the dangers. You know, if you think about it, if I just came up to you and said, right, you need to eat more fruit, and you think, okay, fine, whatever. It doesn't stick, does it? Whereas actually if I say, you need to eat more fruit or vegetables or whatever, because this will have a long-term impact on your health and you will struggle and suffer, then we sit up and take more notice, don't we? They warn of the dangers. And the same is true for Jude's letter. He is going to get to telling the Christians, what the faithful believers, what they can do differently. But first, he's going to warn of the dangers. So look at verses 5 to 10 with me, if you've got it open in front of you. The first thing Jude does is give some Old Testament examples. Over verses 5 to 7, he picks on three stories with the, from the Old Testament that are, I guess, more or less familiar to us today and would have been much more well-known to his readers at the time. The first thing we get is the story of the Exodus. I want to remind you that the Lord at one time delivered his people out of Egypt. Oh, we've been thinking about this in the 9:30 service, if you've been following along online or if you've been there in person. God rescued his people. He sustained them in the desert. But over time, a large number of people turned away from God and away from trusting him. And because they refused to trust God, they were destroyed in the deserts. Then Jude points people to the angels who are facing punishment. Now, this is where Jude starts to go more into the kind of obscure territory. He's probably referring to Genesis 6, it's the bit before the story of Noah, right back at the beginning of the Bible. Basically, angels left heaven, giving up their place at God's side to live on earth. And they faced God's judgment as a result. They were punished. And thirdly, Jude points us to the examples of the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's from Genesis 18 and 19. If you don't know the story, suffice to say, as Jude notes, they were infamous for their sexual immorality. Now, these might seem a bit of a hodgepodge of examples, but each story points towards a group of people who have rejected God's grace and faced punishment as a result. And this is exactly what will happen to those who have tried to pervert the grace of God in Jude's day. Look at verse 8. In the very same way, on the strength of their dreams, these ungodly people pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and heap abuse on celestial beings. In the very same way. Jude is setting up a direct comparison between these people in the Old Testament and the people in his day. These people have come to church and they are turning away from God based on their dreams. It's, I think he's talking about their ideas, their priorities, what they want to see happen, rather than being formed by the word of God. They're polluting their bodies, using it for sin rather than for the glory of God, as the Christian is called to do. They're rejecting authority, putting themselves in charge, heaping abuse on celestial beings. Now, that might seem a bit of a random one. I don't think it's particularly common today. But the idea is that it's pride. It's saying, actually, I know best. When someone abuses someone else, they're convinced that they know best, that the other person is in the wrong. Like these people in the Old Testament, they are rejecting God's ways and doing their own things. And then we come to Michael in verse 9, and what on earth is going on here? Well, it feels like it should be a reference for something that's going on earlier in the Bible, but if you go hunting, you won't find it. Jude is quoting from a contemporary story, kind of like a dramatization of a bit of history, in the same way that you were watching a film and it said based on historical events, which means something vaguely happened that was a bit like this and we've turned it into quite a good story. It's that kind of idea. The Testament of Moses, which is what this is from, is an interpretation of the events at the end of Moses' life. And we'll get to Enoch in a minute. Jude is using it to make a point. Michael is an angel of God, and even in his exalted position of one of God's holy messengers, he won't abuse a greater spiritual being, the devil, in this case, even though Michael is in the right. Jude is showing the foolishness of these dangerous individuals who heap abuse on those greater than themselves. And he quotes from something that that people would have known at the time to help them understand and relate to the point that he's making. And so it naturally leads to how the section finishes in verse 10. Yet these people slander whatever they do not understand, and the very things they do understand by instinct will destroy them. These people are so wrapped up in themselves that they think they know what's going on, that it will destroy them, that it will lead them away from salvation, from a place with God. They don't understand the Christian message, even though they're in church. This whole section, these five verses from 5 to 10, well, they're making one single point. These people who have entered the church, who pervert the grace of God and deny Jesus Christ, are destined for one thing: destruction. There's no point in hiding it or dressing up it in any other language. This is deadly serious stuff. It's the reason why Jude uses such strong language. And let's remember that Jude is speaking to Christians, to things that are happening in church. This isn't about contending with the world for the sake of the faith. No, this is focused on what's happening inside the church. And so rather than saying living and let live, we want to contend for the faith, because the stakes are enormous. The reason why we should continue to contend, to set out clearly what the Bible says, to refuse to just go along with things, is because there will be people coming along to church, serving in churches, even leading churches, who are trying to pervert the grace of God and deny Jesus Christ. We need to be on our guard. As many of you know, before we came to Cambridge, we lived in Devon. And when we moved there, it was the first time we'd ever had a garden. Previously, we'd always lived in upper floor flats and things like that. And having a garden, I set myself the challenge of growing some vegetables. So the first year, I dutifully cleared a spot to try and grow some carrots. Now, carrots are, by all accounts, not particularly challenging in terms of kind of growing things. However, I'm an extremely incompetent gardener. We'll get to that in a minute. So I dug out the weeds, bought some seeds, planted them as the packet instructed. But over the course of spring and summer, nothing grew. Out of all of those carrot seeds and all that effort, I got nothing. Until the following winter, finally, I was digging over in the section and ready for the following year and found the world's smallest carrot. Only one, but it was about the size of my little fingernail. It was a bit embarrassing, honestly. It wasn't great. Now, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter. We didn't starve. But when you've set something up for success, when you're expecting something to be fruitful, there's something wrong, isn't there? There's a problem. It's not great. And whether it was down to something that I'd done wrong or something that was the matter with the soil, well, we don't know. But there's a problem, isn't there? And actually, the same is true in the rest of life. It might be investing in, I don't know, music lessons. And you go lesson after lesson after lesson and cost after cost after cost. But if you don't get any better, well, there's something wrong, isn't there? There's an issue. And that's another marker that that Jude highlights that is wrong with these people within the church. They are destined for destruction because of their fruitlessness. Jude, again, he basically copies the same way of illustrating his point that we just had in the previous few verses. So he starts again with some Old Testament examples, three more. We get these people compared to Cain, again from Genesis 4. Someone who wouldn't listen to God when encouraged to follow God and not sin. He heard God speak to him and turned away. Then we get these people compared to Balaam, this prophet who had heard God speaking to him, who eventually ends up turning away from God's people and being killed for fighting against God's people, even though God spoke to him. And then finally, the people of Korah's rebellion back in Numbers 16. These were people who had heard God speak through Moses, encouraging them to faith, and yet turning away from God. Korah wanted to be named leader of God's people only for his benefit rather than because of the calling of God. They're actively sinful. They're actively turning away from God and not showing God's message in action in their lives. And this picture is filled out in verse 12. Woe to them. Oh, sorry, that's verse 11. These people are blemishes at your love feasts. It's the impact that they have on the church. Love feast sounds a bit weird. Language has moved on. We don't refer to it as that anymore. What they're talking about is sharing bread and wine together, what we call now Holy Communion. These people look like Christians, but they are showing none of the signs of faith. They're shepherds who feed only themselves. They're like clouds without rain in a desert place in the Middle East when this was written. Clouds mean rain. If you get clouds without rain, there's something wrong. It's a fruitless cloud. An autumn tree without fruit and uprooted, twice dead. Again, it's fruitless. And these are all pictures that the Bible uses quite regularly of the Christian. A Christian should be bearing fruit. It's what Jesus says in John 15, if you want to go and look that up another time. We are to produce the fruit of faith. We're to increasingly live for Jesus. And Jesus says, well, there's none of these things here. These are not fruitful Christians. And so they face destruction. That quote from the book of Enoch, another one of those contemporary pieces of writing that's interpreting the Old Testament, that's putting a kind of contemporary picture on what's going on, makes the same point. You see that in verses 14 and 15. They point to God's hostility towards people who look like Christians, but are actually nothing of the sort. Jude exposes them for what they actually are. Verse 16, these people are grumblers and fault finders. They follow their own evil desires. They boast about themselves and flatter others for their own advantage. Jude's not mincing his language, is he? This is serious stuff. This is a serious problem for the church and a very serious problem for those people. Now, around our country, there are many lighthouses, tall buildings that have stood for several centuries as beacons for sailors. They are shining lights that warn of dangers nearby. They shine out for many, many miles in all directions. They're so powerful, you can see the beams of light passing over the sea as they rotate. The thing about a lighthouse is that it's a passive warning. The lighthouses or the lighthouse keepers, they can't change the direction of the ship, can they? They can't do anything in and of themselves. They can't get aboard the vessel and alter its course. And that's for the captain and the crew to do. However powerful the lighthouse is, it simply stands there as a warning for those who come near to stay away from the danger of rocks or treacherous coastlines. And I think that's what this passage is for us today. It is a lighthouse passage that warns its original audience and us of dangers nearby. There's a warning of ungodly people sneaking into the church, people whom faithful Christians are to beware of and are urged to contend with. They cannot live and let live. They must be alert to the dangers at hand. Now, there's a warning for the people themselves too. God has given a clear, single message to the church. It cannot be changed based on our own opinions or the wills of the time or the spirit of the age. There is only one Saviour, Jesus Christ, no other. God has set out in his words his grace and how he expects Christians to live, and no other. The Old Testament is littered with examples of people who tried a different way and were destroyed. Now, God, in his mercy, hasn't done so yet, but that time is coming. In the same way, the people described in these passages, well, their destruction is assured in their present condition. So change. And so the question that's left for us, I think, is twofold. Firstly, I must ask you, in all seriousness, whether you're taking your faith seriously. Are we calling ourselves Christians, coming along to church, but not living for Christ? Are we denying Jesus by our words and actions? Are we producing the fruit that Jesus desires? We should examine ourselves and check where we stand. And if this is not you, if you're hearing this and feeling concerned, consider whether you need to make a change. Likewise, if we see someone in church that we think is similarly in danger, we need to plead with them to take this warning seriously. But secondly, if we are following Jesus, let us be ready to contend, to fight. Let's be assured that this is not a new thing, that from the very dawn of the church, people have been trying to lead it away from following God. It's been going on since the beginning. Let us be ready to fight, establishing ourselves on orthodox, Bible-based teaching, knowing the faith that we profess. I'm sorry that this hasn't been a particularly jolly passage. You know, when the heading in the church Bible for this section is the sin and doom of ungodly people, I'm afraid it was never going to be laugh a minute, was it? But it is a passage we need to hear. It's a bit like a lighthouse. When you're sailing, you never want to come across a lighthouse when you're not expecting it. But if you do, you're mighty glad you found it. In the same way, no one really wants to hear a sermon about sin and doom. But sometimes, it's exactly what we need to hear.